Welcome to episode 18 of the How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams podcast. I'm your host, Emily White. Today, I am so thrilled to have artist Julia Nunes on the podcast. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you, Emily. Good to be talking with you again.
And you're so much more than an artist, that's for sure. I could have said entrepreneur, yogi, meditator.
Thank you.
Lots of other things. But today's episode is called Merch Recon. Before I talk about merch for a second, you definitely define building a sustainable music career. So after we talk about merch, I'm going to take you through your career through the lens of the book, and hopefully we can share some of the great things that you've done and that you're doing with the audience.
Sick. Sounds great.
Okay, awesome. So merch. I mean, let's just, you know, start really basic yet kind of emotional. Like, what does merch mean to you?
Oh, just anything that you sell that is physical instead of like the kind of less physical art.
Right. I get really emotional about merch. That's probably why like I mentioned emotion. But I mean, what do you think about when you're, you know, kind of in that mode, like getting ready for a tour or you know, setting up an album, which is a long process for you in a good way. Take us inside your mindset a little bit, like when you're putting a release together and how merch may or may not factor into that.
Yeah. I really think that merch is something really special to have between an artist and fans. Like being on the fan side, there's certain artists that like I've had merch that I still wear like 10 years after I bought it. So I put a lot of thought into it when I'm selling it to my fans. And my biggest criteria is like, would I wear it? Do I want it? Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think I have just, you know, so much in common with my fans. Like if they like my art musically, then I think they would also like my art in terms of like styling clothes or, you know, merch isn't just clothes, but yeah, just any aesthetical thing that I enjoy. It seems like I really tend to hit the mark with my fans. Like there's an understanding there that always feels pretty on.
Absolutely. And you said something really interesting as far as being a fan yourself, that you have merch from like 10 years ago. And to me, that speaks to two things. One, it was awesome stuff, you know, like you said, something you would want to wear even though someone else designed it. But two, it was quality if it's mm-hmm. still around 10 years later, which I think is really important as well.
Yeah, quality is something that really makes me like, that probably takes the longest out of anything. Like the designing is kind of easy because I'm simple. Like I like simple styles. But the quality, like I think that it's kind of wild how different a white t-shirt can be brand to brand, mm-hmm. just like the shape of the neck, the thickness of the fabric, the way the fabric feels. Like that stuff is as important when it comes to merch as it is when you're just like buying your regular wardrobe if you want people to actually wear it.
Absolutely. And I'm only thinking of this now, but I tour managed the Dresden Dolls, I mean, for years, but we'll just throw 2005 out there. I have quite a few pairs of cotton Dresden Dolls undies that are in amazing shape that are clearly over 15 years old. And I was pretty good about doing laundry on the road, but like when you're touring like all year, sometimes you just have to grab a pair of new undies from the merch table. And so 15 years later, like, so shout out to JSR Merchandising in New Hampshire for your undies. I mean, honestly, like they are in top shape. There's no reason for me to take that to the textile recycling at the farmer's market by any means. So yeah, quality is super important. But take me back to the beginning. I mean, you know, like, I'm sure you were self-fulfilling for a long time and you still do a lot of self-fulfillment through Kickstarter and stuff, which we'll get into. But yeah, I mean, do you remember like when you, like the first merch item you made or thought of or anything?
Yeah, it was a shirt that a fan designed. People were basically like asking repeatedly if I would make t-shirts because I had some shows coming up and they were just like, are you going to have shirts? Are you going to have CDs? And I was like, no. And I was really like, you know, I've had to like work through this in so many areas of life, which I think like a lot of artists come up against, which is like, you know, who do I think I am? Like, why, what makes me think a shirt with my face on it or my name on it is like worth making? Like, that's narcissistic or that's like self-impressed and I don't want to come off that way. So I really resisted it at first. And then I caved in and I was like, if you guys design it, then I'll print one. And I just got like thousands of submissions. And there's this really old picture of one of my first shows with me and like five fans all wearing my t-shirts. And they also have my lyrics sharpied on their foreheads and arms. You know, that's probably over 10 years ago. And I know that some of those kids are still around listening to the music and buying the merch that I make now, which is like, you know, I'm just so flabbergasted by like the design of that shirt was a doodle, basically like a ukulele that had wings. And you know, the stuff I make now musically and merch wise is just like so different, and we've all grown to have aligning styles still years later.
That's really incredible about getting the fans involved with the merch design. For anyone that does that, and we, my company manages Julia, so this is something we've done with Julia since then. But make sure that you have the artist sign a work for hire agreement. So then you can, you know, so pay them some money. Hopefully you have some cash, like if there's a fan design, and then, you know, we talked in the business affairs episode about work for hire agreements. They're very standard, but that gives you the right to, you know, press up that design on a t-shirt, poster, things like that. We've done quite a few fan designs over the years, and we've never had an issue with a fan not wanting to sign a work for hire. So just a disclaimer on that, because I don't want someone to do that. It's such a smart, great idea. It's just like, well, I know this wasn't necessarily your mentality, but it's just like, well, that's the people you're selling it to. So like, have, you know, it's all a community, right? Like, see what they come up with. But yeah, I just wouldn't want to see an artist do that and then have a fan with a attorney, parent or something. And then,
for sure.
I mean, you have an attorney parent, but
that's true. But I wanted to say, like, I've also learned so much about, you know, like asking people for free work since then. Like back then I was like, oh yeah, just like send me a design and I'll pick one. And I think nowadays, like that was back in like 2008, and I had just never heard of any sort of like workmen's agreements around like what's fair. And now I realize that like asking people to like send you work that's specifically for you, with no guarantee that you'll like hire them or pay them is like not cool. And my mode now would be more to find someone. I do this a lot actually, where like I find someone who follows me, and if I like their art, then I'll reach out to that person with like also some compensation just for a trial. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I think that is, the same same philosophy of like, well, these are the people that like my music. And if we're like mutual fans of each other's art, like that's just a harmonious collaboration to base something off of. And I've found a lot of designers that way.
Absolutely. And we also want to, you and I have talked about this, like we also want to educate the fans too, because we don't want to see, you know, a young aspiring artist, graphic designer, like make some amazing artwork and just start like giving it away. I mean, I know like their heart and soul is attached to it, but we're just, you know, I want to educate them as well. I think that's really important.
Yeah, yeah. You definitely deserve to be paid for your work. And I think that that's like a personal choice too. Like there's plenty of fan art that I don't pay for because I didn't ask for it. But I think if somebody asks you for it, here's what my actual advice is. If you find an artist that you like enough to work for free for, but they seem like they have at least some budget, don't let your heart that wants to give it away for free win the the argument with your with your self-value. Like if they can pay you, don't just be selfless and give it to them for free. Like if somebody offers, take them up on it and accept like being paid, because I think that that's like a really important exchange, even just to keep it like, to keep boundaries clear. Because I think also when things get done for free, even between friends, like not even talking about fans and artists, it's like between friends doing each other favors, like I just really highly suggest paying each other, even small amounts, so that it's, I just did this with literally my best friend. She engineered a track for me in the studio and she was like, oh yeah, I'll do it for free. And I was like, no, I want you to like take it as seriously as a job. I want to be able to like do this as pro as anybody else that I'm paying. And I really do think that that sets a certain tone where stuff doesn't linger, not get done, stuff like that.
Yeah, it professionalizes the situation. Absolutely.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Now, merch is obviously far from limited, from t-shirts and things like that. Actually, before I get into that, you hit on something that answered a question for me, which is why an artist might be hesitant to do merch when you're talking about, like, you know, who do I think I am? Like, that is very illuminating, because we had an artist named Kulla on, I believe, episode 12, and he was talking about seeing amazing musicians play. And there's nothing. There's literally nothing available. And the musician would say to him, like, oh, you have CDs. How did you do that? And he's like, these are people that have been playing music for years. You know? So, yeah. So that answered that question for me, which is very interesting. But also, like, I talk a lot on this podcast about monetizing from day one, really, like, prior to day one. Like, I forget how I normally say it. But basically, like, start monetizing like as soon as you start recording, which you do really well, right? Like whether you realize it or not, or you start monetizing before. So I guess that what I'm trying to say is like, it's the same concept with merch. Like, you know, Ariel Hyatt said this very early on in the podcast, and I know there were some artists that picked up on it. Feed them where they eat. I mean, maybe that sounds a little commercey or something, but it's like people can't support you if you don't let them.
For sure. Yeah, I'd love to say more about like what prevents artists from making merch, or even just the grander idea of making money, like having the making of money be a part of your artistic life is really hard for artists, I think. And you know, the best Literature I've ever read on it is definitely The Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer. I recommend it to like anyone who's struggling with this entire idea. But I recently counseled this amazing artist who's a dancer. Her name is Shauna Davis, and she was making a film called Black Eco. And we were set up by a friend who was like, hey, I need to call in a big favor. Can you counsel my friend? Like she wants to run a Kickstarter, but she's like absolutely petrified.
Right.
And we got on the phone. She was like, does anyone actually want a shirt? And I was like, it depends on the shirt. You yeah. know, like if you've got some ugly design, then no. But you know, she's like cool, like pinnacle cool, like LA avant-garde dance cool. So like astonishing to watch her dance. And just like, I invite anyone to check out Black Eco, Shauna Davis. But she was like, yeah, like I feel so apprehensive about offering that, like no one's gonna get it. And I was like, your audience, and I would say this to anybody, like your audience is into your art because it makes them feel a certain type of way. Either, you know, with music, lots of times it's an emotional processing, or dancing, huge deal to like, if you can make music that people move to, like, or are creating a movie that people are watching you move and it inspires them to move. Like there is merch that hits that same note. You know, like the kind of t-shirt that you would wear to a dance class, or the kind of t-shirt that I have this style category I like to call off-duty dancer.
Amazing.
Where you look like you could maybe be a dancer, but you're not like, you know, on your way to a job or anything. You're comfy, you're cool, you're stylish, but not like super polished. I was like, make a shirt for those people.
Yes.
And it was her biggest level on the Kickstarter was the shirt. And like I'm getting mine in the mail soon. You know, just because I was willing to help didn't mean that I was going to do like such a big level. Like maybe I would have contributed to one of the smaller levels, but the shirt was so cool. Totally. I was like, yeah, I'll go, you know, a higher budget for such a cool shirt that I really value my clothes, my style. Like yeah. I don't like to have so much stuff. So when I do buy something, it's because I really, really like it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a good reminder for every artist. Like you don't want to make something, because this is what I think deters people. It's like, oh, well, my art is my heart and my soul.
Yeah.
And how could I possibly have like try to sell people something? Like money feels heartless to artists, but you can put your heart into the art of marketing. You can put your heart into the art of merch design. And if it's coming from a place where you want to give people something, like a shirt to wear to their friends' like backyard party and feel cool, or a bottle to keep them hydrated, or you know, like sweatpants to feel comfy and taken care of, if you've got some music that's like about curling up and processing your feelings, like make merch that feels like that. And I really feel like people want an opportunity to get further into the art that they already like. You're already making something they like, and they want to like wear a representation of that art. That's how I am as a fan. Like I want to be reminded of like that film project, or like one of my all-time favorite bands is Parcels. And my favorite hoodie that I wear like all day, every day is their hoodie.
Totally. That is okay. First, I want merch sweatpants. Have you ever seen anyone do that? I haven't.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm out of the loop. Who has merch sweatpants?
I feel like it's something that huge people do, but there's no reason to not do it as a smaller artist. Like Ariana Grande definitely has sweatpants.
Yeah. Got it. Well, you know, okay. So that's, again, that is all really interesting. And so for those, you know, you're talking about like, you know, your art is your heart and your soul. I mean, we talk about that all the time on this podcast, but your fans want to support your heart and soul. And the kind of, I don't mean average in a bad way, but kind of the layperson fan will very often say, well, I always buy merch because I want to support the artist. And we talk in the Don Passman episode and the business affairs episode, where like, well, if they're signed to a major label and have a 360, that might not be support. So I'm not trying to get too into the weeds or inside baseball, but for the artists who are fearful of this, know that there is a mentality amongst music fans that are like, I want to support the artist, so I always buy merch. So again, let them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's definitely a type of person that I would meet in like the merch line who like straight up doesn't care about what they're buying.
Right.
That's for sure. But yeah, I think that there's like kind of a people who don't have money to spare still buy merch if it's good.
Yeah. And also like, it's really important to have a price point for everyone. You know, whether it's merch table, online, Kickstarter, I was on a call with a merch company today and all these ideas were getting thrown around and I was like, have some pins, have some badges, you know, have some $2 items. So I think that's really important. And, you know, well, okay. So before I talk about, 'cause you just talked about like, you know, people you meet at the merch table, which we'll definitely get into. But again, it doesn't always have to be t-shirts. And I know it can be a little overwhelming when it's like, you can do anything. I mean, first, you know, you want it to be meaningful, right? It's an extension of you. And then, you know, get creative, right? Because it can be expensive to, you know, print some of this stuff up front. So like if it's something you can make, I know we had an artist do like paleo homemade cookies because she is paleo. But I remember at one of your New York shows, you were backstage before putting together flower crowns for you and your band. And then you made like 20 more. So you guys all looked great. You know, you had your flower crowns on stage and then you made 20 or more flower crowns and sold them at the merch table. I mean, brilliant. Not to get like too into the weeds, but it's like, do you remember like what you sold them for?
Yeah, I think I sold them for $30. And I will say like somebody, more than one person didn't like that price. They were like, these are fake flowers. Like, I don't understand why this is $30. And like to that person, I was like, totally don't buy it. do not buy this. But there were only 15. I did two shows, like two release shows where I did that. And before I even started playing music, those crowns were sold out.
Yeah.
Like before I went on stage. And so I think that's maybe another deterrent. Like people don't want to make something nice because they don't want to spend the money on the production that would then make the product expensive for their fans.
Right.
And there will always be people like balking at expensive items.
Sure.
And I think that is kind of a function of like, they want it, yeah, but they're not willing to spend that money on it. And that's just like a confronting thing for anybody. Like, sure. I want that thing. I'm not willing to spend that money on it. And I'm mad that it costs that much. Yeah.
Right. Even though it's homemade by the artist, right? Like it's custom, it's unique. Fake flowers last forever.
Yeah, man. Like and also rare. Yeah. Like super rare. There were only 30 that existed forever and ever and always. And it's like for me as an artist who it, like I'm touring, I'm doing like most of my time is dedicated to other things. So I stayed up until like 3 a.m. working on those things. It's like, I also have to make an amount of money that feels worth it to put in that time. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to, this sounds like, I feel silly saying it, but like, I don't want to deprive the people that would buy it for fear of the one or two people that would try to like shame me for charging that much.
Right. And for any of those people, you know what's free and lasts a lifetime that you're so generous about is a selfie with Julia at the merch table.
Right. Like, I do think it's like a bit strange when fans get aggressive and criticizing an artist for like selling out or certain things like that. I'm like, I'm just so generous with my time and attention. Like, and you have it right now.
Yeah.
Like you have my time and attention right this minute. I'm giving it to you mm-hmm. for no reason. And you're using this like time together with an artist you like to have like a conflict. I don't get it. Just don't buy the flower crown. I don't know.
We'll blame alcohol for that one because I am totally with you. I cannot even imagine going up to anyone and being like, this is too expensive. Like, you wouldn't say that in a store even. You know, that's pretty faceless.
I mean, listen, go to the Renaissance Fair. They've got like $200 flower crowns. So they're merchandising to meet the demand of with the supply and demand of their clientele. So,
well, the thing is, I always feel like there's going to be 2% of haters no matter what you do, even amongst your hardcore fans, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really hard to not like feel that or notice that, but you do have to realize that 98% of people love it.
Yeah. I think Amanda Palmer's book was really nice in that way too, because, you know, like she probably went through the worst of it in terms of being criticized by people that used to love her. And on the other side of it, like she still has such a core group of people who love her. And it's hard to focus on that while it's happening, especially at the volume it was happening to her. So whenever I'm getting kind of battered by a small percentage, I just remember like it's natural for me to feel this upset and like maybe there's something to learn here. But like more than that, I just need to like focus on the people that are actually happy with what I'm doing. 'Cause there's a lesson in that too. To look at the people that are supporting whatever direction you're going in.
For sure. I talk about this a lot with Melissa, your manager, my business partner, with artists, even with athletes. Like, it's really, you know, talk to myself about this. It's challenging to do, but I think it's really important to not get too high on the highs or low on the lows.
For sure.
And this falls into it. Like, I've heard, you know, we've had Justin Vernon from Bon Iver on the podcast. You know, he said something like, I'm not as good as my best review and I'm not as bad as the worst fan comments. I mean, he didn't say it quite like that, but I think that's a really healthy mentality.
I love that. Yeah.
Me too.
I'm not as bad as my worst criticism and I'm not as good as my best review.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's really like, that's the other side of it, of like, not allowing the hype to take you.
Yes.
And not getting cocky. I think that that's like the total reverse of the, like, oh, I don't want to print merch because who do I think I am? Like the other side of it is like, why could like print shit and they would buy it? Like, if you ever get to that place, I just,
I think that that's what makes other artists scared. Like, sure, they're afraid that they'll turn into somebody who's just like printing nonsense to like grab more money.
But are there people like that? You don't have to name names, obviously, but like, have you gotten that vibe?
At shows, I've definitely gotten the vibe that like the merch is just like a cash grab, and that the way that it's being handled is really sloppy as well.
Right.
But it's really like at shows, like being in the fan position, everything's a factor. Like, honestly, the attitude of the person selling the merch is a factor.
Yes. I actually talked about that. I had Brian Viglione on my first podcast. I have a book before this and podcast before this called Interning 101. And I was the Dresden Dolls merch person for a long time. And I think it's one reason why I get so emotional about merch. And I know this has changed a little bit with the proliferation of the internet, but I used to be the conduit between the fan and band. I mean, Amanda and Brian, who are the Dresden Dolls, were amazing at coming out and signing. But for the hours before that, right, and the hours before they go on stage, I was the conduit. So to have like a, you don't have to be Midwestern, but like a smiley Midwestern person, you know, who's like excited, it's really important. And again, it was, you know, the internet existed, but it wasn't quite as wild as, or not just wild, but as informative as it is now. So I was also a conduit of information, you know, just like, oh, here's where they're going to be touring next. Here's what's going on. You know, not that you want your merch person like spilling the beans on like unreleased stuff, but I am so with you. So yeah, whenever you can get a friend, family member, you know, someone you trust that is going to care, that's going to really make a difference. And also, I used to say to people if they were mulling around the merch table, like, oh, do you want to sign up for our email list? And then that ended up being so powerful for the band and Amanda in the long term, is collecting all that fan data, whether they bought something or not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that like having an experience of like someone being friendly and like, it's an extension of the artist. It's almost like you got to interact with like a member of the crew of the artist that you really like. Like for, I can just in this conversation, I can remember my times buying merch from people like, yeah, and what those booths looked like. Like I used to really geek out about the setup, like the display. I always, totally, both sides, like as an artist and as a fan, I would just geek so hard about like the Christmas lights, the fold of the shirt, the way it's displayed, the sign, even the price list, like everything is an experience. And that's what I mean by like putting, like there's an art to it, and you can put your heart and soul into something that feels like not a part of your artistic expression. It actually is.
100%. And yeah, I mean that it's just, it's so important. And you know, at one point, I mean, not to like bring commerce right back into it, because I have something emotional to say after this, but at what point did credit card readers come into play for you, and how did that affect things?
Wow. Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, I was doing it before credit card readers. And let me think, could it have been like 2000? Let me think. Okay. My first Bonnaroo was 2010. And I don't think I had one yet.
Right.
And then I played Bonnaroo the next year too. And I think maybe I did. So yeah, it used to be, I mean, this is like what I was saying at the start, like I have always crushed it with merch.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exact numbers, but it felt like my whole career, the merch numbers just went up and up. And like, I would frequently surpass the fee that I was getting paid by whatever club with merch sales.
I mean, the show that you had the flower crowns at, you, like, there was a line of fans. Also, you created a selfie wall that I feel like was flower crown themed, maybe also.
Do you know what was wild is the club had had a bridal party the weekend before.
I didn't know
and
that.
They had, oh, you were at the New York show. So this wasn't at the New York show, but it, this was at the LA show and you were at the New York show. But the LA show, they gave us this balloon arc that had been for the bridal party that was the previous weekend. So our selfie wall was like even more bomb.
Totally.
And then for the New York show, like I think I just got like a tinsel-y background and a border, and because the band wore the flower crowns and we didn't sell them, like if anybody wanted to just take a picture in the crown without buying one, that's like we had crowns there that they could wear. Oh, and the record. So the reason the flower crowns even existed at all as merch was because the record that I was dropping was called Ugh Wow. And on the cover, I'm wearing like a ginormous flower crown that I made. It's like jumbo sized. So I think I also had that. And if you wanted to wear like literally the crown from the album cover, you could wear that in our selfie too.
I love it. I mean, that merch line was as long as a New York City block, because that venue covers an entire block. And I remember saying to your sync person saying this to me, and I've seen him at a million shows in my life. He was like, I've never seen anything like this. And do you remember what you said when I told you that?
No.
I hear that all the time.
I was about to say just now, I feel like almost every club I've ever played, they're like, I've never seen this.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's really cool. I love meeting fans after shows. I love the merch line. I love like people come with poses in mind. And especially my bandmate for the last 4 or maybe 5 years, Chase Burnett, is also just, I love Chase. Check out his music. He's so good. So Chase Burnett and I would just like be having a blast at the merch table, like getting CDs. You know, like somebody asks for a shirt size and you can be like, yeah, sure. Or you can be like, medium.
Like, totally.
It's just like fun. And then Chase is also like a really talented photographer. So like just the lighting, caring about the lighting and the pose and making sure that the person is happy with the photo before they go. Like that was also such a huge part of it. I wanted people to feel like taken care of, because it's actually, I'm more and more familiar with the fact that like having your photo taken is quite a vulnerable position to be in. Mm. Like it's in somebody else's hands and I'm going to look at this like visual representation of myself at an important moment, meeting an artist I love. Mm-hmm. And if I hate the way I look, like suddenly it's dark.
Totally.
It's a dark day. But if you love that photo, you love that artist, you had a fun time at the merch table, then there's just no room for the kind of common experience of like buyer's remorse.
Right.
Like there's just a lot of value to be had. And mm-hmm. I really love to give a lot of value.
And you do. I mean, can you remember not going out to sign? Right? Like, I mean, you've probably been doing that at least a decade after every time you play.
Oh yeah. I've never skipped the merch line. I know artists who have. And I think that like, you know, mental health is a big deal to keep in mind. And if somebody was like, I literally cannot handle that kind of social interaction, I would never like push somebody to do it. But I have to say like, I think it's part of why I have had fans that have lasted for over a decade. Because, like, we actually have had impactful interactions.
100%. And I also remember at that New York show, you, like, I think I went to the merch table to cover it for our intern for the last two songs so she could see your show. And then suddenly your show ends and you are sprinting towards me. You're like, okay, I'm ready. I'm like, do you want water or do you want to pee or something? It's just like you were there before the fans. You were ready to go. It was really amazing.
Yeah, it's years of touring have taught me that if you try to slowly make your way to the merch table, you won't make it.
Yeah. I love it.
People will stop you.
Yeah, so I, you know, there's stats behind all this that I don't have, but, you know, artists are going to double their merch sales, you know, if they hang out by the merch table afterwards, they're going to double their merch sales maybe again if they have a credit card reader, a Square reader, or whatever you want to use. But, I mean, you're exactly right. It's like you are creating a priceless interaction with those moments. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember waiting to meet Fiona Apple in middle school forever after a show. Oh my God. It didn't happen, you know, and you just make it happen. It's really special. Yeah. One thing I meant to comment on, we were talking about the importance of displays.
For sure.
Do you want to share any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the most impressive displays I've ever seen is Walk the Moon. I saw Walk the Moon because we were on two sides of the same venue. Like, lots of venues have a small stage and a big stage. And I was on the small stage. Walk the Moon was just right next door, and I got to go check out just like one or two songs. And their merch booth was gorgeous. Like, the lighting was on point. They had so many different designs and none of them were throwaways. And like, this seems like, you know, innocuous, but the shirts were pulled taut in a t-shirt, like the sleeves were folded like really perfectly. So they weren't just like straight out. They were kind of like folded down on a really perfect seam and, you know, no wrinkles, no, like shadowy, whatever. It's like humans are really aesthetic. Yeah. And if you take an approach to your merch booth, like it's a store that represents your style. It's not just the merch that represents your style, the display of it. And then they were big and they had like a kind of a grid that it looked like they could fold up and reestablish at any venue. Mm-hmm. But I also saw on a smaller scale, like the more what do you call it? Like, I'm trying to avoid the word quirky, like quirky girls, like kind of,
totally.
DIY vibes, yeah. And not necessarily girls, just, you know, more of the homespun type of feeling. I mm-hmm. used to really adore when someone had a suitcase, you just yep. pop open the suitcase and on the back of the suitcase would be the CDs and a shirt and maybe stickers and stuff. And then inside the suitcase would be the merch. And I always thought that that was such a sweet setup. Like, it's not just style too. When you're on the road, it's like ease.
Yeah.
You don't want to like get resentful at what you have to do. Like,
no,
you have to automate the system so that you're having the easiest time, but the most beautiful result.
Exactly. The functionality is really important. I'm so with you on the suitcase that lights up like it's, I actually just watched Pulp Fiction last weekend. So it lights up like that suitcase in Pulp Fiction. Yeah. But also, because again, it should be like part of your gear, right? It's just like, okay, you got the instruments, the cables, the merch suitcase. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I think something, you know, if that's intimidating or overwhelming for people, I think when I used to tour with the Dresden Dolls, like in, I mean, for a long time, but like in the earliest days, we would just have like a $15 clip light from a hardware store. And it just mm-hmm. illuminated the whole merch land, whether we're in some dingy bar or we played a barbecue on the first tour or you're wherever at South by Southwest or whatever, just having that $10, $15 clip light changed everything.
Big deal. Big deal.
I love it. Cool. So, okay, I just have a couple other merch things to cover for people. Yeah, I mean, you definitely talked about if you like it, your fans like it. So, you know, this podcast is called How to Build a Sustainable Music Career. That's the first half. So, yeah, I mean, keep that stuff in mind. So if you want to use, you know, organic cotton, if you want to use compostable packaging, there's a lot of stuff like that available. I know Ambient Inks is a company that definitely does compostable. Am I saying that right? Compostable. I'm a composter. Compostable packaging. So yeah, so just keep all that stuff in mind. Quality, you know, stuff you're into is important for the audience. Do you have any comments on that? I didn't mean to skip, but we kind of talked about that, but.
Yeah, no, I just echo everything you just said.
Cool. And then as folks' careers grow, they may want to look into, I mean, this might come up organically, but if you're touring internationally a lot, you might want, and say you're big in Australia, you may want to have a merch company there because it's really expensive to ship stuff, you know, overseas. So there's definitely bigger artists that, and same with their online stores, right? So a bigger artist might have a North American store, a European store, Australia, whatever.
I spit some wisdom on like quantities?
Yes.
I would highly recommend if you're on tour, making a big merch order, but having your merch company send you portions along the tour.
Yes.
Because I think that is, you want to get the price break by ordering the big thing, but having to make space for like five boxes at the start of your tour and then like two boxes midway and then none by the end. It just like, you could maximize your space by like making the big order and then being like, can you send half now and half 3 weeks in?
Yeah.
I would say don't sleep on 3XLs.
Mm-hmm.
That's like probably the thing that I get thanked for the most is having inclusive sizing. I think that people really forget and maybe even just order like a very small number of them, but it actually like if somebody is on the bigger side, then they might even just skip, like, sure they could fit an extra large, sure. But they want it to be like a more loose fitting thing, like get those big sizes. Yeah, you might sell way more than you anticipate selling, so don't sleep on those. And then lastly, if you're new to merch, it is tempting to shoot for the price break by ordering some huge quantity. But if you're new and you're not sure how things are going to sell, like I would really recommend ordering a small amount. It's better to leave people wanting more and having to reorder and sure paying just a little bit more per item because you ordered in smaller batches. But, it's better than having like outdated merch that is just sitting there as your style evolves and no longer, you know, it's not something you're pushing anymore. It's cool to like I've had that happen and I've done like big basement blowout sales and that's like fun to get rid of the vintage merch, but I think it's nice to actually clean house along the way and not have stuff like sitting in storage, especially if you're fulfilling yourself, like you don't want to have a bunch of stuff lying around your house.
Yeah. And there's a big movement towards on-demand merch companies. To be totally frank, I haven't had the best quality experience. Do you know what an on-demand merch company is?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So that's like where's, you don't actually house any of it and someone can just specifically order their one piece
right
and print it on demand. And I mean, I think that is cool for certain circumstances, but you make so much less.
Correct.
Per item, yeah. Like, so much less.
So I would say if you're brand new and you have no money, you could try, you know, working with an on-demand company could be a good experiment, you know, to figure out what is working, what isn't working. Julia is absolutely right. As you grow in your career, your profit margins are going to be much better for, you know, with a traditional merch company. So if you work with an on-demand company, I would just ask about quality, because like I said, I've had quality issues with multiple on-demand companies, but I'm trying a new one and I will share their name. They're called Fourth Wall. And I mean, I guess merch companies have investors. That makes sense. But one of their investors is Serena Williams' husband, and they have like $17 million in funding or something. And I was like, wow. I mean, I'm not saying like go work with someone because they have funding, but I was like, well, they're going to be around for a while. I was really upfront about the quality thing. So I'm giving Fourth Wall and Serena's husband a shot.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the longevity of something is really to be considered. Like, if you're trying to expand your what's accessible through you as an artist.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you should have in mind. Like, don't make something cheap that you'll just sell once and then people will have that buyer's remorse. Like, try to create something where someone's really glad they spent that money and that it's quality and that's like a return customer in many ways.
Yeah. And like, this is, you know, this goes across the board, not just for merch stuff, but you know, there are going to be issues here and there, no matter what merch company you work with or what, you know, whether it's traditional or on demand or whatever. And the most important thing is just get back to that fan, replace it, and then they're happy. Like, customer service is just like, communication is queen.
For sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely touched, we kind of danced around this a little bit, but it's important to have a good relationship with your merch company. So they can help you with those projections on the road. They can ship ahead to Canada. They can work with you on, you know, what is sold well, you know, what hasn't. Mm-hmm. So you work with Hello Merch. So shout out to Hello Merch.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's not really a question.
But no, yeah, it is like, so if you're trying to create return customers with your fans, like, you're actually, you don't have as much control over that as your merch company does. So you want to find people who care. It's a big
Absolutely.
Deal.
Absolutely. Yeah. And also just a couple more things that crossed my mind. If you're working with international merch companies, that can be really helpful because we don't always know holidays in other countries. So my best friend was the Dresden Dolls merch person, Laura Keating. She's gone on to do many more things. But I mean, both of us have stories of just like chasing, you know, FedEx boxes in Europe on random bank holidays we didn't know about, you know, so they can help give, you know, if you're just like, oh, have it delivered on a Monday and then it's Guy Fawkes Day or whatever in the UK, you might not be able to get that gear. I mean, but we've also crowdsourced that. I mean, Laura probably a little bit more than I, where it's just like, okay. Or I think one time, like, and this is legit. I don't know. I'm messing up stories, but you get the idea. Like, maybe FedEx was shut down because of storms or something. So she had the band post like, hey, if any fans can like pick up this merch at FedEx or something, like free guest list for the rest of tour or whatever. I mean, sometimes you just like have to work with what you can on the ground. I also wanted to add kind of similar, work with what you have. Speaking of Laura, so Laura's sister is Zoe Keating. I keep referencing previous episodes. Zoe was on, I believe, the second episode of this podcast. And I was tour managing Imogen Heap, who's also a guest on this podcast, and Zoe. And I needed a merch person for Europe. And Zoe said, oh, my sister would be great. She puts up hardware store displays at a hardware store in upstate New York. Anyway, so in Dresden Dolls world, of course, you know, we had to try her out first. We couldn't just say, because in all seriousness, merch is super important. I mean, that's what this episode's about. So Amanda had a solo show at Joe's Pub in New York City, and I was so busy managing, tour managing, doing a crazy guest list. And I come back, and also the merch setup is really weird at Joe's Pub. It's like, behind the stage and hard to find. And Laura had found some duct tape and some scissors and cut out. I mean, it didn't look like creepy, like serial killer writing or something, but like cut out the letters and the numbers and stuff to make a merch display out of duct tape, scissors, and a music stand. So, you know, I mean, I would just grab, like, when I was doing merch, if I needed, you know, just like go to the bar, find some paper, a Sharpie or whatever. But yeah, so don't get intimidated by like these setups or anything. It's like, you just have to, I mean, you know, like Warped Tour founder Kevin Lyman, I mean, there's stories of him like, okay, see that pile of wood? We need it for the stage. Go, you know, it's just like, you just use whatever you need. So
yeah. Getting creative is like such an integral part to merchandise. I really love, like making it work.
Me too. Okay. So last thing on this topic, which you alluded to, sales and specials / promotion. So I remember probably during the pandemic, your merch company came to us and was like, we have all these, you know, custom Julia ukuleles in our warehouse. I don't know who thought of it. It was them or you or us or whatever. But someone's like, let's run a flash sale. And we sold out of like 100 ukuleles in a few days.
Yeah, I did not think that that was possible. Because even at a flash sale, it was like still $100.
Totally.
So, it's still like kind of a big expense. And yeah, just immediately. So I think in under a day.
Yes. And you're so good at that. It's just like, cool. If there's something that's been sitting around for a while, it's just like, you know, you're like, send me one of the shirts. I'll cut it up and I'll do something creative and post on social. So yeah, I mean, your merch store online for the most part is just going to sit there if you don't promote it. And again, we have all these holidays and we have all these, you know, different reasons to offer discounts and share stuff. So do it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of reasons to put extra oomph behind something. And like holidays are definitely one. Like I really like to remind people around Christmas time, not just about my merch, but like any artist's merch or small businesses. Like I've worked with small businesses before to make merch. And I think that around Christmas time or any like gift buying holiday, it's just like worth it to remind people that it's like a more heart-based purchase to go for something that's like an actual human being.
Yes.
Rather than a costume.
Awesome. Well, that concludes the merch portion of this podcast. Anything else you want to add about Merchland?
All good.
Okay. They're experts. We covered it. All right. So now I'm going to take you through your career a little bit through the lens of the book. So chapter one is called Get Your Art Together. So my question for you on that is, when do you know that you are ripe and ready to record, as opposed to maybe like feeling like you're forcing it?
Wow. Well, I have to say my opinion on that has really changed recently. During the pandemic year, and even before the year started, just like at the beginning of 2020, I decided to record one song a month, original song, and it's because I had let songs like build up in me without recording them. And just kind of like, I had this mentality of like, oh, like eventually, and eventually never came, because recording is expensive. It takes like some real planning. You have to find like your team and like to do the whole thing. And if you're doing it alone or in a smaller group, then you have to have some sort of constraint to get you to finish it. And so that's where this idea to commit to releasing one original track a month came from, to just like force me and Chase Burnett, my bandmate, to like finish it. And like I needed to do that so that I could do what I'm doing now, which is more high-end recording of more current songs. Like, I spent 2020 releasing like a lot of breakup tracks that I don't feel anymore.
Like, yeah.
It's great. I love songs even if they're not relevant to my life anymore. But I think the recording process is more gratifying when the lyrics really still speak to you. And what I'll say, this is my advice, and it's not like I wouldn't say like everyone should do exactly what I'm saying, but this is my advice. Like, I would record one song at a time. If you've got a song, I would just put your everything into the one song and like finish it, make it everything you want. And if you've got an album in you, just go one song at a time. But I do think that the climate of the music industry has been veering towards singles for a long time, and it's never been more like intelligent to just release singles. Like, TikTok culture is just like built for singles, not albums. I don't even know if my current manager Melissa would agree with that, but that's just like what I'm seeing out in the world.
Oh, she would totally agree with that. We talk about that a lot, and Spotify is the same way. We had an artist on the podcast who I mentioned, Kala, who releases an album every year on his birthday on his website. But then this is something he's learned, even though we know this, unfortunately, kind of in a creepy way from the head of Spotify. But so it comes out on his birthday in April. You can get it on his site right now. But then he releases each track to the DSPs, Spotify, Apple Music, blah, 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 every 2 weeks. And then that's leading into the album being available on Spotify in full in September. And so he learned last year, he released two songs during the same week, and one didn't do well at all. But when he does it every 2 weeks, like, the algorithms love it. I feel really gross saying that, but I, you know, there's in a weird way, there's something liberating about that too, because like when we first started working together, you were recording Oh Wow, and you were putting a lot of pressure on yourself as far as deadlines and release dates. I was like, you own your label and your master recording. Like, you made up the release date. Why are you making up a release date to create stress for yourself? So, you know, maybe that's another way of looking at, I mean, again, another artist said it on this podcast, feeding them where they eat, or these algorithms, as obnoxious as that is, because again, I know I mentioned Fiona Apple. It's like, she releases like one album a decade, and it's always so worth it, right? So everyone's process is different, how they go about that. But I mean, I think it's so beautiful what you said about, you know, I forgot exactly how you said it, but like singing the lyrics when you still feel that way, I mean, is just so powerful. So that's really interesting. And I have talked about you on so many interviews and so many podcasts, in particular with what you just talked about, the releasing a song once a month. So yeah, on one hand, I'm jumping around a little bit. On one hand, I think it's really important to wait until, you know, you intuitively like know you're ripe and ready to record. But you also bring up a really great point. And I know there's artists, I think Zoe Bookbinder was one of them. I think she was like trying to write a song a day. Maybe she was even putting some of those sketches out for people. And I mean, what better way to get better, right, at songwriting and recording all this? So there's no right or wrong answer. But anyways, I'm jumping around a little bit. But what I was going to say, where I've talked about you a lot, is, you know, you were releasing a song a month on the first song and video on the first of every month in 2020. And then when the pandemic hit, you obviously haven't had immense compassion for everything that's happening. But as far as, you know, your music career goes, you were like, is it the first of the month yet? Because you were already in that process. And yes, you had to cancel a tour. But yeah, you just kept putting it out. And I think that's really important for people to understand. Like, I know I'm super grateful that there's people listening to this and there's people learning, but you have to be nimble too, because I think it's okay for you, for me to say, you know, okay, so you're releasing a song and a video a month, and then George Floyd is murdered, and there's Black Lives Matters. I can't talk right now, but you know what I mean? There's protests going on. And it's like, so many artists were going through that, right? I mean, we're talking about merch before and feeling weird about that. It's just like, when there's people being killed in the streets, how are you like, here's my t-shirt? So we talked about giving proceeds that month to Black Lives Matter and the ACLU and supporting these organizations. And obviously a lot of artists did that. So I guess my point is just be nimble. There's no right or wrong. I'm huge on intuition, but you have to be nimble with all this stuff because you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it just comes down to like using your platforms for good. Like when I think the whole nation was being called upon to do better, and that was like an opportunity to do better. It's just like, send the money where it's needed most.
Well, and again, like, my book, this book that this podcast is based on, came out in March 2020. So it's like, awesome release date, right? The whole world shuts down. But again, it's just, no matter what happens, like, you know, just be mindful of the situation. I think like the first piece of promo I shared when this book came out was, I was on my friend Ariel Hyatt's podcast. And so I posted and I was like, want to pretend it's a few months ago? Listen to Ariel and I on this podcast, you know? So you just want to be sensitive to what's happening. You don't want to put out a press release on September 11th, 2001, which I know an artist who called their manager and did that. And she was like, she was in New York. She couldn't get a hold of her mom. She's like, the world is ending. And he's like, yeah, I saw something about that on TV. So you just want to be a little aware of what's going on. Maybe it's a little easier now in the age of Twitter. I don't promote my book as much anymore right now, but when I was in 2020, I would literally look at what was trending on Twitter to make sure some horrible thing didn't happen. And I wasn't like, oh, here's a 5-star review of my book. So be nimble, be aware. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay, chapter 2, pre-recording marketing foundation, email list, text message club, and social media. I mean, you're way past this in your career, but all I'm saying here is like, before you hit the studio, because the point of the book and the podcast is taking people through the, you know, from recording to release and creation to distribution. So get, you know, your email list, social media handles in place, all that good stuff before you hit the studio, because when you're ready to share your baby, you don't want to be like, oh, I do want to be on TikTok, or I do, you know, oh, wait. I mean, most people have their social handles in place, but how about this for a question? Do you remember, I mean, I know I should know this, but when did your career start and when did social media start?
My career really started 2007.
Okay.
I was in college and there was no Instagram yet, but there was Twitter.
Yeah.
And YouTube was really like, it's weird. I don't know that this is all the way accurate, but it seems like it was the only social media that I was really on. Like, Twitter existed, but I didn't do it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I know that LiveJournal and all that existed. But yeah, I didn't get on Instagram until I moved to New York City in like 2010.
Great. So talk about the importance. I mean, that I'm not terribly surprised to hear that that was the timeline, because you know, your career in social media intersect so well, you use it so well. So talk about kind of the origins of that and maybe how you use social media now. Like, I mean, I loved your post the other day. That was like, tell me how you feel only in emojis. And that's so natural and funny and not forced, you know?
Well, I was in like a bathrobe and a head towel, so I looked exactly like that emoji of the woman in the shower.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that social media is really like, it's just another relationship that you need to have with yourself, like any other substance. Like it's as addicting as caffeine, yeah. as constant as food, as like dopamine inducing as the best drugs out there. So you have to like utilize it in a way that actually nourishes your career and your life. And I would say that I'm still like fine tuning my relationship to it. I actually delete Instagram really regularly. Mm. And I download it really regularly too. Like I used to be like, oh, I can't delete it because then like it's, you know, it's such a big deal. And now it's actually like not a big deal at all to delete it and then re-download it like even 24 hours later. Like I just don't re-download it until I have something to post.
Totally.
Really cuts down on the mindless scrolling. And it's been hugely important. I mean, I think that even in the last couple of years, like I've like Kickstarter is basically all Instagram. Like I would post one thing on YouTube, but most of the promotion just happened on Instagram.
Interesting. And you are a six-figure Kickstarter artist, which we will get into. Yeah. I don't know if I ever mentioned this to you. I haven't done this in a while, but I went through a phase of turning my phone and computer in the colors off and turning it into grayscale.
And, yeah, you taught me that. Okay, it was so helpful.
Yeah, that is really a wild thing because these top computer programmers that go to Stanford and MIT and all that, I mean, they are literally taught at these amazing schools. Here's the colors that are addicting, or here, you know, red will make you do this or whatever. So the thing that is wild about it is when you turn the color back on, I feel like I'm tripping and all I'm doing is looking at a food ordering site. Right. So it's just like, yeah. So breaks are super important. Actually, I mean, you actually just answered it. Yeah. I think that's brilliant that you delete. I was going to say, you know, what do you do for social? Actually, you should answer that. What do you do for social media breaks besides deleting Instagram once in a while?
Yeah, I delete the apps. I think that's the biggest thing. And I also have like a time set in my calendar called dark mode.
Nice.
And that's just like time to be with no technology at all. I also do no tech days, which is really fun.
Like, so good.
I just plan ahead, let everybody important know that I'm not going to be on my phone, and then just blink off of the face of the internet for a full 24 hours. And that's really when I get the most clarity about my career too. It's like, oh, the second I get my computer back, I'm going to message this person because I really want to collaborate with them.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I am so with you. Rest and breaks are so important. That's really, really good to hear. Okay, chapter 3, every musician's favorite topic, get your business affairs together and fair compensation.
Oh, boy.
You know, do you have any thoughts on this or how do you – it could be a simple – not as simple, but how do you handle co-writing? You know, that's – I mean, that's something we've been really open about. And I mean, you can comment on any of this stuff, not comment.
Yeah, I mean, what I'll say is like you – and Melissa, as my managers, have been like such a relief to me as someone who, like, I just felt like I could not wrap my head around these things. And you've explained it to me, and your book is helpful. And then just having negotiations and stuff like that handled, like Chase Burnett and I had to have many conversations about writers splits, and it felt so much more smooth with knowing that we had you guys to turn to if we ever got stuck. Because even like Chase and I have like a genuinely fantastic friendship and communication and like trust built up. And even still, it's like a scary conversation to have.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's my two cents is like, if you can get somebody to explain it to you, and if you have somebody that you can turn to when, if you get lost, like that's the best setup of all time.
Well, you know, you've been even before we met, and we met in France in like 2013 or something, way before that. I mean, you've been definitely an advocate for owning your master recording rights. So why is that important to you?
Oh yeah. I mean, that's the lawyer parent coming, nice. Coming into play. I have always felt like there's almost like a flip switch that can turn a career into something, what's the word? I don't know. Like, what happened to Taylor Swift? Like,
totally.
She didn't own her masters and everything just got shitty for a while. Like, fuck, I can't imagine. And I just listened to some of her re-recordings and like, that's great, but it's different, and people fall in love with like the tiny minutiae of a track, like the little tones in your voice, and I know that she has plenty of highly loyal fans that are like, I'll never listen to that again, like the ones that the other people own, but I think most people will probably just keep listening to the ones that she doesn't own, and it breaks my heart because, like I said, like your art really is your heart and soul, and I think that losing control of it, no matter what is promised to you up front, in the long run, it just sucks. I mean,
yeah,
I just the stories I've heard make my little artist heart curl up in a ball and sob.
I had one of those stories happen this weekend. I don't feel super comfortable sharing it, but yeah, an artist who's on a label made something, and that something will not be released.
Oh no.
And you know, we have opinions on releasing it, like do it through Patreon, like your fans will love this, but it breeds that insecurity, right? Of like, oh no, well, wait, but the label does, I mean, I don't know if I'm making sense, right? But it's just, then it's just a mess, right? And Melissa and I are like, do it, this is so good, your fans will love it. But now there's that fear, right? It's like, well.
Is it like the label said like, oh, this isn't good enough, we're not going to release it?
Yeah. Oh. Or we don't like, I mean, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but obviously how the artist felt was, we don't like this.
Damn.
Yeah.
That sucks. Yeah, I mean, that's another crazy part about it is like the artistic vision. I think one of the really common conversations I have with artists about labels and managers, no offense, you've never done this to me, so it's not about you, but like people that know nothing about making music and people who are not at all your target audience trying to say what's good and bad, like I find it to be like totally useless to listen to like most people other than
your like, heart.
Your heart, yeah.
And that's what I'm saying about you know, when I mean she trusts these are actually good people. I mean, not to like be rude to the audience, but I'll explain this to you afterwards and you'll be like, whoa. But what really sucks is like, she made this thing and people are like, oh, we don't feel super great about this. So even if she's like, I love this so much, that's even harder to do, right? Because she's already been told like, just as a sensitive human being, right? It's just like,
yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that's a huge thing. My partner reminds me a lot is just reminding people, because I'm obsessed with the modern music industry, because if you have access to a laptop, for the most part, artists can record and distribute now on their own, right? And but that's another huge component of it that I grew up with, was when you sell your rights away, you don't have a say over what is released, when is released. And it's really easy. I mean, I don't forget that stuff, but I meet students all the time who have no concept of that stuff. So, yeah, it still happens. Still happens on 4th of July weekends, and that needs to be dealt with. So, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead if you have anything else.
Well, I think what I want to say is, like, there's something – there's stuff that a record label offers that is valuable for sure, but – this is something that you've always like reminded me of, which if I just look at my own career, I can tell is true, is like more than any resource or external pump to your career is your relationship with your fans. And if they like what you do, then whatever you make, even if your label doesn't like it, they probably are gonna like it. Like if they like you, they like what you make. And I think there's like this silly little inspirational quote that I've always thought was really good, is like, it's not up to you to determine if what you've made is good. It's up to you to put it out.
Yes. Absolutely.
Like, it's up to them, like the public, to decide if individually they think it's good, but like it's not up to you to decide that for them. It's just up to you to put it out.
Yeah, it's really hard for us as managers because we see the long game of like, oh my gosh, her fans will love this. but that's our job, right? And the label's job is to, I don't mean this in a dirty way, like exploit that recording and exploit that song and video as much as possible. They don't care. I don't mean this to be obnoxious, but it's like, it's not their job to care about the artist fan relationship when she's 75. And to me, I'm like, oh my God, the fans will love this. They'll never forget this, you know? And that's what it's all about. So moving on to another sexy topic. Oh, wait, no. Actually, we do have kind of a sexy topic first. Chapter 4 is how to record with or without a budget. So tell us about how you started to get into recording and, you know, what tools were available to you when you were figuring this stuff out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was just on an iMac with the built-in microphone.
Amazing.
And I remember getting a laptop and people noticing an audio decline. They thought it sounded worse on the laptop built-in audio. So I got my first microphone. And I've tried a few, but I just circle back around to the Yeti by Blue every time. It's the best.
That is what I'm talking to you on right now.
Amazing. And then the recording software, I think, is also like important. GarageBand has a certain interface that makes things sound a certain way, and Logic sounds different, and Pro Tools sounds different. I personally use Logic because I'm not willing to do the learning curve of learning Pro Tools, and Logic and GarageBand are really like user friendly and kind of have the same vibe. So that leap was pretty easy for me. And then, yeah, Logic just has like really, really good plugins. You just find sounds you like and mess around with them. And then, for the track I'm recording right now, I went to a real studio with like a real vocal setup. 'Cause I think the vocals are probably some of the most important factors of my music.
I love it. That's a really beautiful evolution. Okay, now on to the not sexy topic. Chapter 5 is music publishing isn't scary or confusing, plus how to land a sync placement. So I am not trying to call you out with this example. I'm trying to help other people. But when we first started working with you, I asked you what your publishing situation was. And do you remember what you said?
Probably, I don't know.
You said, I don't have one. And I was like, oh, wow, that's surprising. And then I asked you, and I totally understand why most artists wouldn't know this. And like, when you were distributing with TuneCore or CD Baby or anything like that, did you ever check a box that was like, want to make more money? And I think you said no. And then we went up and signed you up for SongTrust to collect on your music publishing. Because again, if there is a like subtitle or theme to this podcast, it's if you are just signed up for your PRO, you are missing money. And that, excuse me, that was the situation you were in. So we signed you up for SongTrust. And then I don't remember how we found out if SongTrust system bounced one of your albums out of there or something, but you had checked that box with TuneCore once. So they were collecting your publishing administration. I just think it, and we've since done this for you, but I just think it's nice to have all your publishing in one place. So you're not like, oh, I get some money from TuneCore. I get others from CD Baby, others from SongTrust. So how about this? Do you understand that now?
I would say minimally.
Well, here's the thing I want you to understand to share with your songwriter friends. If you are just signed up for a PRO, do you know what a PRO is?
No.
It's okay. Performing Rights Organization. Does that help?
Cool. Okay.
ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC. I think you're ASCAP.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So if you're just signed up for ASCAP in the United States, for example, you are missing out on money, which is why you need to sign up for SongTrust as well. That's what I want you to understand. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Because they collect money from like all of the places on the internet on your behalf.
All of the places for your songwriting, basically. And so ASCAP is just performance royalties for your songwriting, and SongTrust is everything else. So there's a whole bunch of sub-revenue streams within music publishing that I would never expect anyone to memorize unless they work for a music publisher. All I want artists to understand is that music publishing is songwriting, so it's not anything to be scared of and run to the hills over. And that if you are just signed up for ASCAP or BMI or CSAC or whatever your country's PRO is, you also need to sign up for SongTrust. Otherwise, you are missing money.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yay! So that was the case with you. And I don't usually, well, I guess I'm sharing it with everyone now, but I share that example often without saying your name. And because that's very concerning to me, like you have this amazing career. And really, like, you were an inspiration for writing this book. I mean, hopefully this isn't – that's a positive and negative thing because we started working with you. What?
I don't disagree with anything you're saying. It's alarming. It's alarming that I don't know these things and that if I'm, like, so established
– yes.
I've been doing it for so long, then – what's happening with the people who are brand new?
100%.
You don't have to worry about hurting my feelings. I want people to hear, because especially like if that's your situation too, you don't know this stuff. Like, you don't have to feel bad about it. Just learn from Emily.
Yay! And I, like I said, the SongTrust thing is, or the not collecting on publishing info is very common. It's important to me that people understand that. But I think the other thing that inspired a chapter and like kicked my butt to write this book is that I was finding money for you. And I was like, totally. Oh man, I'm like, if this is and like the industry is right to do this because you are so good at so many things, but you had also really been put on this pedestal, in my opinion, of being like the metaphysical business child of like Amanda Palmer and Zoe Keating. And I know Amanda's business very well, or I did for a long time. Obviously, Zoe is a family friend, and it's not always what it seems, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And so if I'm finding money from one of the poster children of the modern music industry, what about everybody else is what I'm trying to say.
I think that's totally legit. Yeah.
Because the industry was pointing at you being like, she's doing it right. Be like Julia. And I'm like, I totally agree. You know, like I love everything you do, everything that's public facing. But then when I pulled back the curtain a little bit, I was finding some money. So I don't know. I don't know if that's inspiring to people or depressing to people or what.
Yeah, I mean, like, if I was going to speak to that, like, I would just say how it looks is important in certain ways. Like, I have had a lot of success. And, like, this is where that block comes in for artists not wanting to, like, make money a focus, is that I was like, not getting money that was like definitely mine.
Yeah.
For no other reason than I just couldn't confront how scary it is to address money.
Yeah. But it's there, and hopefully I've laid it out, you know, in checklists and all that good stuff, so you can just make sure. I don't even really care. I mean, this is going to be a weird thing to say. I don't even really care if people remember what these revenue streams are. I just want them to look at the checklist in this book and be like, oh, wow, I'm missing Sound Exchange. Oh, wow, I'm missing Songtrust. Like, that's what I – and then if you want to go back to the chapters and be like, oh, Sound Exchange is how I get paid for plays on Pandora and Sirius. Like, great. But no one's going to quiz you on that. It was so – frustrating and heartbreaking to be finding money for you and another national act that we started working with around the same time, where I know we said this, but I'm just like, oh man, if this is happening to Julia, then it's happening to other people. So hopefully we're solving that.
For sure. Yeah. And I'm very appreciative.
Thank you. Okay. So the second half of this chapter is how to land a sync placement. You just had a really great placement on Ginny and Georgia. Do you want to talk about, that's what that show's called, right? I'm not really the demographic. Do you want to tell us about that experience?
I got a song placed on a Netflix show. It's gotta be someone who's tapped into like my kind of world of YouTube, because there were two other of my like internet friends featured on the episode as well. So I really think someone's like watching our little internet crew.
Yeah.
It's probably something that I have talked about, wanted, tried to like speak into existence for like over a decade. And it was exactly, I like literally would say I want it to be like a coming of age, like moment where there's like a camera like panning around a kiss. And it's like that and so much more. Mm-hmm. And it's great. And got a sizable check in the mail.
And a streaming bump.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, that's really like the thing that I wanted to happen, is that people would be like, into the song because of the scene, the way, like, I don't know if you were ever into these shows, but like I got really into a lot of the soundtrack of Scrubs and Grey's Anatomy.
Nice.
So those shows like really created certain artists. And I had just always wanted someone to experience my music the way that I got into music from those shows.
And I don't know if you remember, but because it's funny, you don't remember approving the brief and I don't remember approving the brief. But then when you asked, you weren't even like accusing, you were like, did I approve? I'm like, you must have. I never would have approved a sync without you. And then when I checked, it was like we all approved it, yourself included, of course, on like July 4th, 2020 or 2019. So it was clearly just like 4th, we're just, you know, on retreat, but, you know, whatever. But I do remember you completely, like, you read the brief and you were like, it's always been my dream for my song to be in a scene like this. So you understood that even from the brief. I don't know if you remember feeling that. And no, if so, no. How did it feel to then see it come? Because, yeah, that was your reaction. I was like, wow, she's really getting it. I'm just seeing, like, sync, Netflix, yes. You know what I mean? But you're just like, oh, this is my dream.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, that song in particular was, like, kind of about my life falling apart. Mm-hmm. And it was also, like, the first time that I had worked with a producer that kind of elevated me to a level of really feeling like I could compete with artists that I'm a fan of.
Yeah.
And so to have that one be the one that went through to the other side just felt really gratifying. And especially like the scene itself, it's like the kind of sex scene where everyone's clothes stay on and it's just about the tension.
Yeah.
And like even that, the fact that it was that kind of sex scene that like teenage Julia would have been like, that's the kind of sex I want to have. Like, I can only imagine if sex scenes like that existed when I was younger, like what my preconceived notions about sex would have been. And I think it would have been helpful.
That's such a good point. I mean, that, you know, it was the number one show on Netflix for a reason. So it was clearly connecting with people.
Oh, yeah. It stayed there for a while.
Even through her Taylor Swift controversy.
Yes.
And Scott Cresto at Music Alternatives landed that sync. So people know that. That one didn't come out of thin air. So
thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott. And also, I don't even think we knew the show's title. I mean, that's one reason Scott is really, or no, I know. Cause again, you and I didn't remember approving this. Like we approved it like a year ago or whatever. And then it was happening. And when I went back and looked at the brief, I'm like, it doesn't even say Netflix. So again, we trust Scott. You were excited about the scene, but that's happened to me a few times where I've probably told you this. I went back. Maybe I was looking for something else. And I was like, oh my gosh, we almost had a song in Lady Bird. And it's like, you approve this stuff before you know what, I mean, again, you have some information, but you don't know it's going to be Lady Bird and nominated for all these Oscars or whatever. So fun times.
I have a funny, like, totally unrelated story, which is that I helped my roommate do a self-tape audition for Euphoria. And so we were, like, I was, like, jokingly doing the scene with her of, like, Rue and her childhood friend in the bathroom, like, flushing drugs down the toilet. Just, like, truly fucking around the entire time. And then later watching the show and being like, why do I know these lines?
Right. Oh my gosh. Amazing.
So funny. The entertainment industry is like such a wild ride.
It's fun, but you got to stay grounded too.
Amen.
It's important. Take those social media breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, chapter 6, setting up your release and distribution plan. So I don't know if you've ever thought about your releases this way, but you definitely start monetizing very early on. Like I said, you're a six-figure Kickstarter artist. So I don't know, take me through. I mean, your releases are always different, right? You know, you were just releasing a track a month, but yeah, tell me any thought process you might have when you're putting a Kickstarter together and how far in advance of that how far in advance do you do your Kickstarter? It's way before the album is out is what I'm saying. So talk to us about kind of pre-orders, Kickstarter. Where did that start for you?
Yeah, just the sooner the better. Like I've done things last minute and I've done things like with so much planning and it's so much less stress when you do it with a lot of time, especially when it comes to the art. If you're going to do any merch with it, like the sooner you get on that stuff, the better. Like you don't want to be making decisions because you have to.
It
really sucks.
Exactly. And it's like, how heartbreaking is it for both of us when you see an artist that you love, especially if they're developing and stuff, and they're like, okay, here's my masterpiece. And it's just like, that's it, you know? Like,
yeah. Oh, sorry, my timer is going off.
No worries. But yeah, I mean, you do a phenomenal job of like, okay, like, tell us about the A Wow campaign.
Yeah, I designed everything myself. The photo is something that Chase Burnett took while we were on tour. We actually had kind of a loose approach to doing the art because we know that, like, we do, when we're collaborating, specifically us, we work best like on the fly. And when we put too many constraints on it, it gets like not fun. So Chase and I would just like, if we had a day off or whatever, we would like go to a craft store and buy stuff and make content, like make scenes and costumes and adornments and then take pictures. So we did a lot like on tour, many, many scenes and outfits and stuff like that. And then that one just happened to be on the last day of a tour at like 3 a.m. in my hometown. I came out of my childhood bedroom and he was staying in my sister's bedroom. And I had like smeared makeup and I was wearing a flower crown just like cuz. Yeah, like a hoodie, a flannel, and a flower crown. And he was like, stay right there. And he took all of these pictures of me. And the face that made it to the album cover just like said, ugh, wow. It was like not happy, not sad, pretty tired. But like raw, especially like the circumstances around it. Like we had just played a hometown show, which is always like a lot. And then from there, it was easy to kind of like find a theme because the flowers were this like big red thing. And that played into like all of the merch and then messing around with the typeface, same thing. Like it just, I played around with it for months before I picked something. And now that typeface is like such a satisfying marker of that era, like the primary colors of it, the slant of it, like there's just such a concise marker of like what the style of Ugh Wow was, with the flower crowns and that typeface. And really all you need is just like some defining characteristics to whatever you're about to release and then stay within that realm, like use that level of constraint to be creative. So that was like a big project and that was the approach for that. And then with the monthly releases, we had so much less time to put like thought into the music videos and style and all of that. And so the same concept is still there though, of like finding one defining characteristic, like just the lighting or what I'm wearing or the room we're in, or just the editing style. Like what's the thing that's specifically about this song? And once you find that, you can kind of build a house around it.
Exactly. And again, not to get down and dirty when you just said all those beautiful creative things. But again, I mean, you have been monetizing that album well before it came out in advance. So that's what I really want to get across to people. What are some things that worked well for you in any of your Kickstarters or pre-orders? Like what has worked well? What are things you've learned?
Showing people the music before, like having some music done is a big deal. Like my biggest Kickstarter was one where I basically had like an entire track in that was finished in the video. Nice. Promoting. Yeah. It.
People just wanted more of that.
Exactly. Yeah, they could hear the direction I was going. They were on board. They thought the song was catchy, and they were like, "All right, let's make that a reality." Cool. Having a really good T-shirt, like I was talking about with Shauna Davis, and Black Eco, and then things that kind of speak to what you were saying of like having something for every price point. Like, mm-hmm. I really recommend having something that's really expensive.
Yeah.
Because there are people that can spend that money, want to spend that money, and making it something that's like something you actually want to do. Like, I've had ones where I would play a show. And that was a great idea, and those were really fun. The custom ukulele was a Kickstarter idea, and those did really well.
How important is like the add-on tiers on Kickstarter? Does that make sense?
You mean like after the Kickstarter is done?
Yeah.
I've made an extra like 5 to 10K in the add-ons.
Yeah. Actually, that's not what I meant, but that was really interesting to me when it happened. So that's good for people to know.
Great. Okay.
But also what I meant is, like say I buy a CD and then I decide I want the T-shirt later. I like how you can go in and do that and not have to like start all over, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important. I think, once someone is down to buy one thing, they're just so much more likely to buy more. Yeah.
And again, you get their data, you know, you get their email addresses, and then you can communicate forever. So thank you, Kickstarter, for sharing that data. We appreciate that. Okay. Also not the sexiest title, or chapter title. Chapter 7, How to Market With or Without a Budget. What does the word marketing mean to you, if anything?
Yeah, just honestly, anything, any content you put out that's free for other people to consume, I would call under the umbrella of marketing. You know, even just the music you put out is like a form of marketing yourself.
Sure.
Marketing your shows, marketing, like, wouldn't it be cool to be a fan of my music?
Wouldn't it be cool for you to give me your email address and your cell phone number? Wouldn't that be cool? Okay. Any advice on FOMO in the age of Instagram as far as this category goes? I mean, or life, but you know what I mean?
Do you mean like,
why does this artist have that? Why do they have what? Like, I just feel like FOMO in marketing has gotten, I mean, I'm sure it's always been like that. Like, why is this artist in Spin Magazine and I'm not, or whatever, but it's just like, algorithmically in your face, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's challenging for everyone. Like, why does this person have like a beautiful, happy life and I don't, or something, right? But it seems really prevalent. I mean, this is just the world we're in, but it's like, it seems really prevalent in artist communities, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, comparison is the thief of joy.
You know it.
Yeah, I think that can really like put a damper on your own pursuits if you're just kind of like hyper focused on someone who's ahead of you in the race. And I feel like there's maybe like a Cardi B quote that's like, I kind of want to look it up because she's prolific. I'll butcher it. Just fair warning, but she's like, don't be like a jealous person, be like how can I get on that person's level?
Right.
Like, let it inspire you. Don't let it like knock you down.
Exactly. Like, I just think like the grass is always greener on the other side. Focus on your own green grass. Right. But if you truly can't handle it, if you're like, I'm just losing, like, how did this person get this thing? And the thing might not even be that valuable, to be honest. But like, how did they get this thing that I want so badly? If you really can't handle it, reach out to them. see if they're down to like get coffee or do a Zoom or whatever. I mean, that's something you couldn't do in the pre-digital era. If you're like, oh, why is that artist in Rolling Stone? Like, how did that happen? And so now, you know, now you can talk to people. I mean, they need, it's the art of asking, right? I mean, they need to respond or whatever, but it's just like, you know, and you'll learn. It's just like, oh, it was my publicist. Oh, that's a friend from college that writes there. That's the only piece of press I've ever gotten. You know, like you just, so reach out and find out, but also know that they might have FOMO over you and the things that you have.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about FOMO is like, if you're suffering from FOMO, you're suffering from FOMO, and it doesn't really like, doesn't actually matter what position you are in life. Like perspective is what you actually need. Because I think even just like being able to make art to some people is crazy. Like I know people that are like, gosh, I wish I could sing. And I forget to be grateful for the fact that like I can sing and write a song.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, my mom knows what FOMO is, but that's fear of missing out for people that don't know. And if you don't know, that's okay. You know, my mom's pretty fairly with it. When I mean with hip things, I mean, she's very with it like mentally or whatever. Okay. A couple marketing things specific to you though, even though I know you don't necessarily think about it this way, tell me about music videos. I mean, you've made so many, you are definitely, I mean, you are an artist first and foremost, but we also get emails from people from brands and stuff, which I'll talk about in a second, who clearly view you as a YouTuber, which you also are, but you are an artist first and foremost. So tell me about, you know, your journey with music videos and YouTube.
Boy, yeah, I've done every type. I've done music videos that are really high end and high budget. I've done music videos that cost me nothing, shot them on an iPhone. I built my career on music videos that cost nothing and were shot on the built-in camera of an iMac. So, you know, my best like advice to people is, a B plus idea. And this is stolen from my friend, Shervin Linez. He's a photographer that I did.
I know Shervin. Tell him I say hello. I haven't talked to him in forever.
Oh, he's the best. he said a B plus idea is that you can execute is better than an A plus idea that's like out of budget and like you can't pull off.
Love that.
Yeah.
Well, amazing. That's great. Okay, so I have a little part at the end of this chapter because called brand sponsor and endorsement partnerships, because to me, this book and podcast is all about here's everything you should be doing and the money you should be collecting. And I think there's way too much attention. Oh, wow. Breaking news on this podcast. I swear there's like a tornado coming through.
Oh shit.
It's okay. It just got wild and windy in New York City, but we'll be okay. So brand sponsor and endorsement partnerships. We get quite a few emails from brands wanting to work with you because you have very high social engagement numbers. Did you know that? I don't know if that's ever something we've talked about.
Yeah. 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 No, it's like the same as merch tables. Like,
right.
You know, some people have huge numbers that don't have high engagement. I feel like,
correct.
I feel like I actually like vibe with my fans. Like we hang out in the comment section.
Yeah. And so that's really important for people to understand, you know, for two reasons, I think. One, like you just said, it's not always just about following. It's those engagement numbers. And then two, you know, you turn down brand stuff, obviously, not obviously, but I guess it's just obvious to me, more often than not is what I'm trying to say. So yeah, any thoughts on brands, when you work with them, when you don't work with them?
I think that there is a balance that you have to have between like the content that you're providing that's like the art that they want to consume. You know, it's really like a risk to expose your fans to like a commercial for something that isn't your art.
Right.
You have to actually like believe in what you're doing. And if you don't, then, you know, it like, I feel like a lot of what we said in the merch part applies, because like if you get just like cash grabby about it, you'll lose people's attention, because rightfully so, they shouldn't be subjected to like half-assed low quality shit.
Exactly. Yes. Agreed. Okay. Your chapter eight is your live strategy and efficient touring. The main thing I want to talk about here is house shows. If you can share, you're literally in the book a few times, and definitely in this chapter talking about house shows. So maybe share some of your experiences with that, and also what you've been up to in the live space during the pandemic, which to me is, not to answer the question, but releasing a song and a video every month is a lot of work. But yeah, talk about that.
I think that I think touring is like something that you have to figure out the way that what you need in order to be a successful human being on the road. Like, I actually kind of love the way that touring focuses my energy of like, how do I become the most energized person on stage tonight? So like my day is consumed mm-hmm. by things that will make me feel like I could win the night, you know?
Yep.
And that means like taking really good care of myself, hydrating, eating food, like, it's the kind of thing where you have to fine tune. Like, I have weird idiosyncrasies. Like, if I eat 2 hours before the show, I'm like uncomfortably feeling food in my stomach when I'm trying to sing. So I can't, I either have to eat after or like 3 hours before. Mm-hmm. And I also life hack, gargle with salt water almost every night. And I really feel like that would just clear out any, like once I started doing that, I just would be all the way healthy on tour.
I love that. Do you literally just add salt to water?
Yeah, just warm water. And I would like buy a salt that would have a cap.
So cool. I don't, I mean, they must exist, but I don't know a great performer that doesn't take care of themselves on the road.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely toured with bands that are cuckoo bananas when it comes to their health, but even those people, I feel like as we became adults exactly. together, because it's been so long, mm-hmm. like you just have to, you end up whether you wanted to or not yes. becoming
you have to.
More conscious of your health.
I totally agree. One other thing I wanted to add about, well, actually, can you share a little bit more about house shows, and we can cut this out if you want.
Right.
Yeah. But like, do you think you'll return to house shows? That's the part we can cut out if you want.
Yeah, no, I'm actually unsure.
Yeah.
Because like a venue has insurance.
Right.
And there's like less on my shoulders and mm-hmm. less like good faith that's necessary. Like things are being handled for me. Whereas at a house show, like I really was taking a risk every time I went that if like just kind of good faith that nothing would go wrong.
Right.
And nothing ever did. Yeah. But like gosh, I just if I went to a house show and like everyone got sick, you know?
Yeah.
I just like couldn't handle that. And yeah, I'm not sure. I'm actually like the entire idea of touring right now is just like a lofty like I'll address my feelings on that when I've had a little bit more time to recover from this pretty intense year. Cause right now it just doesn't feel like the move for me.
Right.
But I do know there's plenty of people going back on tour, and more power to them.
Not in homes necessarily though, which is
right. Yeah.
Which is what you're getting at. And I think, you know, like we talked about, you need to be smart and you need to be nimble. So maybe artists limit private shows or house shows to a Kickstarter, to a pre-order. And along with that, I'm not an attorney, you know, like you should definitely consult a music attorney about this, but have some sort of disclaimer or language, right? So and so then again, you're scaling it down a little bit. You know, you're still creating that intimate experience, right? But maybe you're doing five of them or something as part of a Kickstarter and not a national tour, which you've done before.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've been on like 60-day tours of all living rooms.
Yeah, exactly. But you obviously play regular venues as well, and we've also done some nice VIP packages for you. So, you know, that's something I want to highlight for people as well. Like, you know, whether it's a soundtrack party or, yeah, I mean, that's a very viable revenue stream for a lot of artists that I feel like they don't always take advantage of.
Yeah, I think that that's really like an interesting place to look if you're trying to maximize what you can make on tour. I think that I'm kind of uncommon in a bunch of ways because like I would always make money on tour.
Right.
I think what a lot of people don't understand is that so many artists just barely break even. Mm-hmm. And that's such a shame, like to expend that much energy and put yourself through the gauntlet. Not that touring isn't fun, but you know, it is a lot, a tax on the energy. And yeah, if you're in that situation and you have some extra energy to do like a VIP meet and greet type of sound check party, that I would highly recommend that.
And again, like you're so right about energy levels, and I'm just throwing the sound check hang idea out there. But again, they're coming to you, right? Like you're going to be there anyway. Don't get me wrong. You need that break. You need that mental space. I tour managed for a long time. I totally understand that. But that's easier than let's go to a yoga class or something together. You know, I mean, right, I don't know if anyone's ever done that, but
I would do that.
Yeah, exactly. You get the idea. Now, maybe obviously feel free or not to answer any of these questions, but when you say, you know, I made money on tour, was that mostly the house show tours?
Both. I would say because of the merch. Yeah. Like, yeah, even at a venue show, I would still generally make some money. And I also would have a really, really small band for that reason as well. Like, there's different levels of investment you can make. Like, I know there's kind of this, like, legendary or maybe just to me article by Jack Conti, who's the music producer of Pomplamoose, when they went on tour and lost.
Yeah.
They made like a ridiculous amount of money, but when you total all of their expenses, they actually lost like a huge amount of money as well.
Yep.
And that was like really scrutinized by the public. And I think like what Jack just kind of was trying to illustrate was not like their own choices. It was like, this is what happens. Like, I don't know what you people think is going on for your favorite bands when they tour through town, but if they have like a 5-piece band, yeah, if they have like a tour manager, if they have a bus, if they don't have a bus, like all of this, like here's the expenses of being a touring musician. So, and then Jack's priority was different from mine. He wanted to put on like the most fantastical show. So he had like high end, really right, pro musicians and a sound guy and all of these things that, you know, you pay for that. And if I had had those things, I don't think I would have made money on tour either.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And, you know, we're going to have 3 touring episodes coming up. But I think in short, which is exactly what you're saying, is I feel like as you grow, do not add bells and whistles you don't necessarily need, right? Like, so as you get, it's like, if you're growing, then you're doing something right. And it doesn't mean because you're selling more tickets or you're bigger and there's more money, oh, now I need a tech for every instrument. It's like, well, if you got, you know, if you just had a monitor person or a backline tech to handle everything before, stick with that, right? And I know you're a fan of Ben Folds and you've opened for him before. I remember being in Australia. I may have told this story on the podcast before, but because he produced Amanda Palmer's solo album. He's a fan of hers as well. So we all happened to be on tour and the artists were just talking, and Ben said, yeah, I remember my business manager handing me two tours for a budget, or two budgets for a tour once. I can talk. One was with a bus and one was without a bus. And there was like $100,000 difference. And I was like, I'll roll up to Jimmy Fallon in a van. I mean, it was David Letterman at the time. I'm dating myself, but my point is, yeah, I think the way, Melissa and I just talked about this, for an artist who was, got offered a tour to open for a big, got offered a tour, got, I really can't talk today. Yeah. Got offered a tour to open for a big artist in Europe. And it was like, okay, how do we, and she couldn't afford it. And it was like, how do we cut the expenses and increase the revenue? And I was like, can, you know, we hire some of the band members from the headliner's band? Can we do VIP soundcheck parties? So, yeah, we're saying the same thing, is like, the more you can keep expenses down and also increase revenue, the better. I mean, yeah, it's all a balance, because there's mental health stuff going on. You know, it's like not everyone needs their own $500 hotel room, but maybe once in a while, it's not six people in a hotel room. So it's a balance.
Sleeping on the floor is like a young man's sacrifice.
Yes. I remember there was a young band I was managing a long time ago, and I went out for a few shows with them. And they had there was maybe like six people on the road or something. They had their sleeping system down to share a hotel. I was like, wow, this is the most like polite, like, I can't even describe it. It was just like, okay, now this person showers, like now this person, but they all had their spots. Like, so, but there's only so long you could, it's a balance people. Yeah. But my point is if you're having success on the road, you don't need to add every bell and whistle. I mean, when I was tour managing, which was a long time ago, a tour bus was $1,000 a day. I'm sure it's more, and there's more expensive a day. So,
yeah. And people forget that even if you have a tour bus, you need to get hotels every like 2 days at least for people to shower in.
You also need to get a hotel every night for the driver, which is something learned the hard. I mean, I knew that, but the Dresdendals were opening for Nine Inch Nails like the month I graduated from college, and I met my tour managing mentor the night before that show. Shout out to Chewy Smith. And he was like, call me anytime you need anything. If it's the middle of the night, or like, you know, someone's stressing you out, or you just can't figure something out. I had to call him like 2 days later, because again, we're the openers, so we're making $500 a night. We only have a bus so we can keep up with Nine Inch Nails routing. And then what I'm trying to say is so long story short, I couldn't find a hotel room for the driver within budget in Vegas. It was really difficult. And then I called Chewy, and this is the magic of knowing tour managers. He's like, oh yeah, I have a family friend that, like, you know, will charge you $50 for a $200 hotel or something. I'm like, done. I mean, he saved my butt on that one. So yes, all very important stuff. Okay, so wrapping up, we talked about merch, obviously. We talked about different revenue streams. There's a chapter called Repeat and Grow, which I feel like you do really well. I don't know if you have any thoughts on growth in your career. Because you keep putting music out, right? That's what I mean about repeat and grow. It's like, okay, we've gone through all this stuff. Every time you do it, you get better, hopefully musically and at understanding this stuff. And then you start over. Hopefully that's exciting and not depressing. Hopefully it gets easier each time. Maybe not easier creatively, but easier with this other stuff.
Totally. Yeah, my thoughts on it are like, growing is a completely non-linear thing. Like, you could be doing the same thing again, but like everything is different. The internet is growing at this like crazy pace. Yeah. Your fans are evolving. Like, there's so many ways to do it that you kind of end up experimenting every single time. So the stuff that you can repeat and just do the same way you did it last time, like just find those and be grateful for them. Like if you're working with Song Trust, or you have a distribution company that is really working for you, like try to repeat as many things that were working as possible, because you're going to be experimenting on like the grandest level anyway.
Yes, I agree. Okay, two more questions. I know it's a long one. Our artist interviews are always long ones because we're going through your entire career. The final chapter is, when do I need an attorney, a business manager, and or a manager? Defining an artist's traditional team. So any thoughts on, because you actually do have a pretty full team. I think that might surprise people. I mean, you have a booking agent, you have a business manager, you work with us. So any thoughts on, and something that's interesting about that, I don't know if you've ever heard of Don Passman or his book, All You Need to Know About the Music Business.
I've heard of it. I have not read it.
Okay. So he was a guest on this podcast, and that was the book. It still is the book. I'm not saying it isn't. But before I interviewed him, I was like, I should reread it. And that book was written in probably 1990. I think it came out in 1991. His first chapter is my last chapter. So in the pre-digital era, you needed a team to do all this stuff. And I'm saying you can do all this stuff and then add team members where it makes sense. So any thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes having a team can be like a layer of stress that you don't need. Mm-hmm. Like people waiting on you and other people to communicate. Like if you're not working with anyone, you're not in a bad position. You just have a lot of freedom. And, you know, if you blow up and you're like, oh crap, like I've blown up and I don't know what to do with it because I don't have like all of these people, like rest assured, those people will come knocking. Like if you're blowing up, people will reach out to you, and being discerning is really important. Like I'm so grateful to be working with Emily's company and Melissa, and just like having a level of understanding with how, like what our priorities are, because I just obviously know a lot of musicians where the priorities don't line up. Right. And there's kind of it's a long game. Like you're saying, like thinking about having this go until I'm like old, you know, Whereas a lot of managers are like, there's like a timetable and a pressure, and something that I think is really important is just like being able to communicate with your team no matter who it is. Mm-hmm. And if I was going to tell you to find like the first member of your team, I would say a collaborator.
Yeah.
Like just someone that can talk you through places where you might get stuck, like on strategy and stuff like that. Just like anybody else who understands what you're doing, who either is going to be a part of your project or just like a sounding board who's not necessarily a part of the project, and have that be someone that you really, really vibe with. And from there, like, don't sign anything without having a professional check on it. That's, you know, you could lose your masters and stuff like that. We already discussed. Your manager should be someone who, like, really gets your long-term goals, not just the short-term like success thing. It's really about like what you want in the long run.
Yeah, you know, something that was really interesting to me that you said once, and maybe this is helpful for managers and industry people that are listening, is you said that, I'm sure I'm botching this, but I think it'll get across. you never felt pressure from us to say yes to stuff. Like it was okay to say no. And I think you had felt that pressure, from some industry folks prior. So I think, and again, I'm not trying to be like, oh, we're so great. It's just, to me, that's just such a no-brainer. Cause again, it's just like, we want you doing this forever. So who cares? And also, like, you are not the type of artist, talent, client, whatever, that like turns a lot of stuff down. You know what I mean? So even to hear, I'm not saying like you do everything all the time, but like there are a lot of artists that just cancel stuff all the time, turns, you know, you're not like that. So to hear you say that is just like a huge reminder for people. Like, we want Julia making music forever, not burning out by the time you're 40.
Yeah. I mean, I think for a lot of artists, the burnout can happen way sooner than that. Like, exactly. If you make it to 40. My mom says this thing that I think is really, like, astute about the music industry is, like, the older you are, the more impressive it is that you're a musician.
Interesting.
Being young and going for it is, you know, like, you're young, risk it all, follow your dream. But if you still have that energy in your 30s and 40s and 50s, like, that really must mean you've like found a pacing that works for you, a team that works for you, an approach, like all of this repeat and grow you're saying. Like, you build your winning formula and you've clearly got it pretty dialed in if you make it to 40, 50. You
know. Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
What's he, like 80?
But I mean, he's a legend. Like, I think that's what I'm saying is, like, he's of the few, right? Yeah. Like, not very many people make it to that age. And I think that it's actually going to be a function of my generation to be someone who's not a legend.
Yeah.
But still old and making music.
But to Mick's credit, I mean, you're right. He's a legend. So it's easy to be like, well, yeah, of course. But, you know, that's a band that was known for partying, right? But like, my entire life, I've always heard about, like, when I was a kid and stuff, like Mick, and again, not everyone can afford this, but Mick would travel with like his own gym on tour. You know what I mean? There's a reason why I just looked, he's 77. There's a reason why he's in his late 70s and can dance and tour and do all this stuff, no matter like how first class it is. You know, like, it's still traveling. It's still a grind.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think people really like, I don't want to like emphasize this too much, but like, I don't think people really understand how intense touring is. And I don't, yeah. I say that as someone who loves touring. Like, I have no complaints and I choose to do it, and it's actually like the best. And like, if you don't take care of yourself, you're in for like a world of hurt.
Yeah.
And potentially just at the end of a tour, when all of the adrenaline runs out, you get home and you're like, Christ.
Yep.
But like, it's just gotta be sustainable. Otherwise there's that burnout that you're saying, and like, yeah, it doesn't take that long to accumulate. It can happen literally over the course of a 1 month tour.
I know I have a journal entry somewhere from the end of my tour managing days where I just say over and over, I just want to be alone. I just want to be alone. Because there's some, you know, I'm on a tour bus, there's someone sleeping above me, there's someone sleeping next to me. It's just like, and I love these people, they're family. But yeah, I those are some of the best years of my life. I'm not complaining, but it is hard.
Yeah,
for sure. Okay, one last question. What does building a sustainable music career mean to you?
Yeah, I would just like take everything we've said over the course of this call and put it all together, like finding your team, finding a comfortable relationship with the idea of making money and marketing yourself and creating products and experiences that people can buy, whether that be like a shirt or like a pre-show meetup, like making enough money that you can make the kind of art you want to make. And until then, making art under the constraints you have and being playful and creative about it. being willing to like start again, mm-hmm. I think is a huge deal. That's how I found living room shows. Being willing to put yourself out there, knowing that criticism is almost guaranteed. And just slowly collecting the people to work with and the methods that work for you and support you in the ways that you need to do this long term.
I love it. Incredible. Oh, we didn't talk about Patreon, and Melissa told us to mention that. So that wasn't the last question. Any thoughts on Patreon, which you are definitely excellent at?
Well, of course. I can just say so much about Patreon. You know, it got me through a pandemic. It got me through a period of my life where I was really, really depressed. And I think that that's where, like, the people who want to pay just to support you, that's where they can be found the most. Because it's really a place where the type of person who's willing to like give you monthly income,
yeah.
There's really nothing you can give somebody that's worth that level of consistency. Like that's just like heart based.
Yep.
And then I do my best to provide something that could come close to being worth it. And kind of related to merch, which I think is the main topic of this podcast, is that when I do my custom merch drops, like I'll tie dye and bleach and mess around with a small batch of hoodies. And I'll let Patreon know about that before the rest of the internet. And usually by the time I make it public to everybody, Patreon has scooped up everything. Mm-hmm. So it's just like the place for the people that are truly like invested, emotionally, monetarily, like invested in you as an artist and you continuing to be able to make art. And that's emotional for me. I mean, I think, there have been times where like I just really didn't deserve that level of support. I wasn't fulfilling the way that you could like really see the reciprocity, the exchange, and people still stuck around. And I've been on that website for 8 years.
Wow. I love it. I want to ask where people can find you, but also I know you lead retreats and do a lot of incredible, important work in the wellness space. So anything you want to share? Where can people find you? Do you have any retreats coming up? How can we better ourselves via Julia?
Yeah, wow. You know, I would say the best place to find me is on Instagram. And I do talk about the coaching that I do sometimes over there. Pretty rarely because my schedule is full up. I have a sold out retreat coming in August. And, I got into coaching actually while I was quite sad, and looking for like something to help me, and like getting coached was the first step. I was like, oh, wow, this like methodology is really helpful. And then, I took a class on it and realized that I find myself doing similar stuff while I'm writing songs or on stage, of just kind of like processing feelings in a non-judgmental way, just kind of looking at them for what they are and figuring out what's next from there. That's like kind of the basis of what I do with my clients. And the two biggest tenets are connection, like connection to yourself and people, and how we really need that. Like it's a required nutrient for all of us to be connected to ourselves and to also connect with people from that place, like not from a phony place.
Mm-hmm.
And then desire, which is like at the foundation of all art and marketing and merch, like desire runs the show in ways that lots of us aren't even aware of. So I like to coach people to get kind of more clear on what desires are coming forward and which ones of them are conscious, which ones are kind of more in the shadows, and just forming a relationship with that part of us that really steers our lives, sometimes in ways we don't like.
Yes. So important.
I think Instagram is the best place to find my music and my coaching stuff. I'll be expanding ever more, and Instagram is a great place for where I announce those expansions.
And you are Julia Nunes Music on Instagram? Or
yes.
Okay, cool. Great. Wonderful. Well, thank you again, Julia. This was so fun. I'm so glad we got to do this.
Thank you, Emily.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Great
to talk to you always.
Yes, same. So that's a wrap for this episode of How to Build a Sustainable Music Career and Collect All Revenue Streams. Tune in next week for the Revenue Stream Checklist episode with artist and activist Steph Reed. Catch you then. And huge shout out to Matthew Wong for composing this podcast music. And of course, to my wonderful engineer, Nathan Kane. Thank you again.